drifted away from the family. Lady Sheridan waved a weary hand. One of those tedious arguments between brothers about their manly honour. I can't recall how it began. Her dismissal of the matter seemed genuine enough. Treddles tried a different angle. Lord Sheridan insisted that there was no estrangement. And I believe that he believed so. Until Harrington died, he was probably still expecting his brother to ring the bell and admit he'd been wrong all these years. Could it truly be so insignificant? An argument that caused formerly affectionate brothers to become strangers? Mr. Sackville's passing does not seem to have grieved you, my lady. I have been brought up to never grieve in public. In any case, we lost him long ago. My husband might not have realized, but I did eventually. I already grieved. Her voice was hard. Inspector Treddles rose and inclined his head. Thank you, my lady. That will be all. Breathe in, Mrs. Watson ordered. Charlotte sucked in hard. Mrs. Watson yanked on the laces of her corset. On Sherlock Holmes's supposed sickbed lay a tangle of scarlet and gold silk, the blouse, skirt and scarf of the Ghagra Choli that she had just taken off. With Mrs. Watson tying the corset laces, Charlotte stepped into her petticoats and peeked at the street below from behind the curtain. She had been followed from the Holmes house to 18 Upper Baker Street. She was fairly certain of that. But now there was no one, and no carriages, loitering below. The doorbell rang just as she finished dressing. Charlotte put the pile of Ghagra Choli into an armoire and took a seat in the parlour. Mrs. Watson went down to open the door for Mrs. Marbleton. Her inquiry had been one of the earliest Sherlock Holmes responded to. Dear Mr. Holmes, I am concerned for my husband. Mr. Marbleton writes twice a day when he is away. If he feels postal services are too slow, he cables in addition. And any time circumstances permit, he telephones. In spite of my protest that it is hardly the thing to do for the lady of the house to stand in a passageway and shout her more tender sentiments for all to hear. I have not heard from him in 36 hours. Instead, a strange letter bearing no return address has come. I cannot puzzle out what it is trying to tell me. The sentences make sense, but why would anyone think that I have the remotest interest in animal husbandry? The letter is typed on plain paper. I enclose a replica I have made of this letter, in the hope that you may be able to advise me. Yours, Mrs. C. B. Marbleton. Charlotte had written back immediately. Dear Mrs. Marbleton, I am very sorry to hear about your husband. Although I cannot ascertain his whereabouts, I can tell you something of the note you received. The text, while coherent, has no significance. However, by examining the punctuation, namely the hyphens and the full stops, it emerges that the letter contains a message in Morse code. Decoded, it says, "Call for me at General." Should you have further need of my service, you are welcome to call upon 18 Upper Baker Street at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Your servant, Sherlock Holmes. And now Mrs. Marbleton had arrived. A woman who had been without news of her husband for more than 72 hours, when she normally heard from him several times a day when he was away. She was pale and tense, but otherwise willowy and handsome. A woman in her 40s, her visiting dress of an elegant simplicity that Livia would have much lauded. Pleasantries were exchanged. Charlotte gave the by now standard speech concerning her brother in the next room. Mrs. Marbleton, with hands clutched tightly together in her lap, tendered her best wishes for Mr. Holmes's health. Charlotte let the silence that followed linger for a few seconds before she asked the by now also standard question. Would you like to know for certain that Sherlock's powers of observation and deduction are very much intact? I was at the General Post Office this morning and retrieved a letter meant for me. I have been plentifully assured of Mr. Holmes's mental acuity, said Mrs. Marbleton, already holding out the letter. Would he mind taking a look at this new one? This letter was not typed. Instead, it was pasted with individual letters, letters cut out from books rather than newspapers, judging by the thickness of the paper. The text praised the material and workmanship of boots cobbled by a Signor Castellani of Regent Street. I already asked around, said Mrs. Marbleton. There is no establishment by that name or owned by anyone of that name. I checked for the hyphen and full stop code from the previous letter, which didn't appear to be the case. I also tried using the crossbars on the T's and the dots on the I's to see whether it was a variation on a theme, and that doesn't appear to be the case either. She'd spoken in a near monotone, as if regurgitating facts that had nothing to do with herself, but Charlotte heard the quaver in her voice, the fear and anguish. She made the usual pilgrimage to Sherlock's bedroom. Mrs. Watson, seated inside, looked almost as tormented as their client. Had news of Surgeon Major Watson's death reached her in a state of unsuspecting naivety? Or had she been dreading that terrible confirmation for days on end? Charlotte didn't know what to do, so she placed the cup of tea that had been brought for Sherlock into Mrs. Watson's hands, and sat next to her for a bit. Upon her return to the parlour, she told Mrs. Marbleton, who had been staring at her own untouched tea, "My brother is of the opinion that this should be a straightforward Bacon's cipher." "What is that?" Mrs. Marbleton's gaze was dark and intense, an intensity that derived not from hope, but despair. "It's a system devised by Francis Bacon to hide a message in relatively plain sight. If you'll examine the letters that have been pasted, they are of two different typefaces, Castlin and Dido, and only those two." Mrs. Marbleton looked closely at the note. "I didn't notice that earlier." "The message starts with a Castlin letter, so that makes Castlin letters A and Dido letters B. If we go through the entire message, letter by letter, we would end up with a string of A's and B's. Mrs. Marbleton, will you write down the A's and B's as I read them aloud?" Mrs. Marbleton peeled off her gloves. Charlotte handed her a pen and a notebook. "Have you contacted the police by any chance, ma'am?" Mrs. Marbleton shook her head. "I do not know everything about my husband. There is a time of his life that he never talks about. I've been glad to leave it alone, as there are years of my own life I would rather forget. For as long as I've known him, he has been a diamond of the first water, a complete gentleman, adored by his friends, admired by his business associates. But if I were to go to the police, I'm not sure what might be dragged up. In public, no less." "I understand, Mrs. Marbleton. You may be assured of our complete discretion." When the A's and B's had been set down and double-checked, Charlotte said, "Now we divide this long string into segments of five letters each, and those sequences ought to correspond with the sequences Bacon had set out as representations for each letter." Entirely translated, the message read, "Package Browns." The fine grooves beside Mrs. Marbleton's mouth etched deeper as she studied the words. Then she swallowed and looked up at Charlotte. "I hate to admit it, but calling for this letter at the General Post Office was nerve-wracking. May I engage you to come with me to Brown's Hotel, Miss Holmes? I would feel less deprived of courage if I didn't need to do this alone." Charlotte shivered. But it was only Brown's, and in broad daylight, no less. Yes, I will accompany you. Mrs. Marbleton already had a hansom cab waiting below, but since Mrs. Watson also wished to come along, in the end, Charlotte and Mrs. Watson took another cab and followed behind. "What did you hear from her accent?" Charlotte asked Mrs. Watson, as their vehicle veered around a large town coach. "English. Or at least, she grew up English. But she has spent time on the continent, America too, at least 10 years there," answered Mrs. Watson. "What do you know about her?" "She was born into generous circumstances, but there was a reversal of fortune in her youth, of such severity that she didn't fade into genteel obscurity, but plunged down to outright penury. She had to work at menial positions." Asking Mrs. Marbleton for help with writing down the A's and B's would make her think she was at least doing something for her husband. But just as importantly, it allowed Charlotte to observe her hands, which had been well cared for. But the repeated burns a young woman unaccustomed to work suffered in a kitchen did not fade away so readily, not even with the help of the best emollients. Obviously, at some point, her future's improved markedly. I can't be sure whether it happened before or after she left England, but my guess would be after. And this is, or should have been, a triumphant return for her, until her husband's disappearance. Mrs. Watson glanced outside before she looked back at Charlotte. "Will you be all right? If it turns out we won't be able to help her." "Will you be all right?" Charlotte wanted to ask, but it seemed far too intrusive a question. "I should manage," she said. The package at Brown's Hotel contained a key, along with a note that stated a room number. Mrs. Marbleton gripped the key, seemingly paralyzed. Mrs. Watson was similarly immobile, peering at her anxiously. Charlotte mustered a big smile for the clerk. "We were told there would be a prize waiting here, but we haven't the least idea who has prepared it for us. Would you happen to have a record of the person who left this package?" The pimply young man reddened.
"Ah, yes, yes, of course. If you'll give me a moment, miss."
He brought out a book of registry.
"This was left behind by Mr. York."
Charlotte glanced at Mrs. Marbleton. The name didn't appear to signify anything for her. "Is Mr. York still here?"
"He left for Paris 2 days ago."
"Was his luggage sent ahead to Southampton then? Which liner did he take?"
"I believe porters came for his luggage, and I'm almost sure he left on a steamer of the French line."
Mrs. Marbleton recoiled at this answer. Charlotte smiled again at the clerk. "It's possible we might need to retrieve some heavy items. Would you be so kind as to send a pair of your stoutest porters?" She didn't anticipate an ambush, but it didn't hurt to be careful.
"Of course, miss. I will have the porters wait outside the room. It might be a minute or two before they arrive."
Charlotte guided a stricken-looking Mrs. Marbleton and a pale Mrs. Watson to a chaise. After a few minutes, she shepherded them to their destination. The porters were in the passage when they arrived, standing with their backs to the walls and tugging respectfully on their caps. Charlotte turned the key and opened the door slowly. The sitting room was empty, but Mrs. Marbleton gasped, rushed toward the mantel, and clutched a fountain pen that had been left behind. They searched the rest of the suite, but no more of Mr. Marbleton's belongings were found. Charlotte tipped and dismissed the porters, then took out her magnifying glass and examined the entire suite, square inch by square inch.
"I gave this pen to Mr. Marbleton as an engagement present. He wrote all his letters with it," said Mrs. Marbleton, to no one in particular.
The rooms had been cleaned thoroughly,
probably by the maids in the morning. When Charlotte had satisfied herself that she would not learn of anything else, other than the fact that no one had slept in the suite overnight, she whispered to Mrs. Watson to keep an eye on their client, while she went down to the lobby and spoke with a different clerk. "The gentleman who stayed in this suite last night," she showed him the note with the number on it. "I might have found something that belongs to him. Do you know if he has already left?"
"Let me check for you, miss," said the clerk,
an older man with a portly figure. He pored over the columns of the registry.
"Let's see. You are in luck, miss. Mr. Marbleton will be with us for another several days."
17. "How perfectly diabolical," murmured Mrs. Marbleton,
when Charlotte told her that the suite in which they stood was registered to a Mr. Marbleton.
"You don't seem terribly surprised by this particular twist of events," said Charlotte. "Only because I now have an idea who might be behind it. And it isn't anyone from Mr. Marbleton's past, but my own."
Mrs. Marbleton smiled grimly.
"Thank you, Miss Holmes. And you too, Mrs. Watson, for your company. But I'm afraid there isn't anything else you can do. Surely we haven't exhausted all avenues of inquiry. Mr. York's movements can be traced. The steamers have passenger manifests, and..."
"I understand, Miss Holmes. But you are assuming it isn't a false trail that has been laid for me."
"Even if that should turn out to be the case, the account on this room probably hasn't been settled yet. Not to mention—"
"No!"
The syllable ricocheted around the room. Mrs. Marbleton took a deep breath, a deathly pallor to her cheeks, and a near frantic look in her eyes.
"Please listen to me, Miss Holmes. You do not wish to go anywhere near this man. You simply do not. Do you understand?"
Mrs. Watson gripped Charlotte's arm and answered for them.
"Yes, we understand."
With flawless courtesy, Mrs. Marbleton saw them out. Charlotte and Mrs. Watson remained silent as they made their way to Albemarle Street. But as soon as they got into a hansom cab, Mrs. Watson blurted out,
"Heavens, what is going to happen to that woman?"
Charlotte had no good answer for her. The rest of Inspector Treddles's afternoon was spent at Scotland Yard, conferring with Sergeant MacDonald and Superintendent Croft, Treddles's superior. Sergeant MacDonald had made little headway in discovering the purpose of Mr. Sackville's London trips, but now, with Superintendent Croft's blessing, they would publish the dead man's picture in the papers, ask for help from the public, and hope that those who came forth would offer useful information.
"And we'll have to verify Lady Sheridan's claims of her whereabouts, too," he said to his wife, when he was at last back home.
They would be verifying a great deal more than that. His latest conjecture was that Lord and Lady Sheridan might each have been plotting against Mr. Sackville, without the other's knowledge, and they each had an accomplice at Curry House, though the possibility existed that they counted on the same person. This dual conspiracy scenario would explain the usage of both arsenic and chloral. One of the Sheridans might have opted for a slow poisoning, the other a rapid one. Neither of them needed to be in Stanwell Moot to carry out their schemes, and their accomplices could honestly state that no one at Curry House wanted Mr. Sackville harmed.
"Have you arranged to see Mr. Holmes again?" asked Alice.
"Or to be in the next room, at least, while the great man remains shrouded in mystery?"
"No, I haven't."
He leaned in and kissed her on her jawline.
"Sometimes I'd rather spend more time in my wife's company than that of any man's, however great."
What he didn't say was that he was reluctant to consult Sherlock Holmes again so soon. He couldn't quite explain this reticence, After all, he'd been desperate to speak with the man only days before. A rare instance of proprietary sentiments regarding his own case, perhaps. He was a thorough and competent investigator, and ought to be able to handle the rest of the work without constantly leaning on someone else. Alice returned him a kiss on the cheek. Ha! And here I was hoping that I might receive more Madeleine, if you would but pay another visit to Upper Baker Street. What maddening inconstancy, Mrs. Treddles. Is your heart so easily given to a box of baked goods?
I never knew it either, sir. But now I at last understand the power of seduction inherent in French pastry.
She handed him two fresh shirts and a pair of beautifully shined shoes. He would be on the overnight train to Yorkshire.
So what is this Miss Holmes like? I'm curious. You saw the notice in the paper, didn't you? Holmes is taking private clients. I'll be surprised if Upper Baker Street isn't inundated. And Miss Holmes is the one who must handle this tide of visitors.
How would one describe Miss Holmes? Do you remember the time we speculated on Sherlock Holmes's appearance?
We concluded that he is likely to be dark-haired, pale from spending his days reading by a lamp, with piercing intelligent eyes, and a somewhat impatient demeanour, since he must find the rest of us trying.
Alice thought for a moment.
I believe we also thought that he'd be dressed well but simply, since he wouldn't preoccupy himself with frivolous concerns.
And if we'd known he had a sister, we'd have expected her to resemble him to a high degree, wouldn't we? Treddles accepted several handkerchiefs and two pairs of socks from his wife and dropped them into his travel satchel. A mind as great as Holmes's must be both magnetic and charismatic. A lesser sibling, without necessarily being aware of it, would choose to imitate the greater sibling, to echo his physical qualities, since those are much easier to emulate than his cognitive prowess.
A very fair assumption.
Which leads me to conclude that either Miss Holmes possesses an ironclad concept of her own self, or that Sherlock Holmes, before his misfortune, had been a popinjay of the first order.
Alice's eyes brightened with excited interest. Goodness! Do you mean to tell me Miss Holmes dresses extravagantly?
When we were engaged, you took me to your favourite shop for trimmings and garnishes.
She laughed. And when we left, you said you feared for your manhood because the place was so overwhelmingly feminine.
If that place came to life, it would resemble Miss Holmes exactly. I counted 16 rows of bows on her skirts.
How extraordinary. I'm not sure I'd be able to take a woman like that seriously.
I'm not sure I did at first, but by the end of that meeting...
Yes?
Treddles recalled all the things she had told him about himself, and the single word in her notebook, Barrow in Furness. By the end of our meeting, I knew I would never think lightly of her again.
As Charlotte's hired hackney approached, Lord Ingram looked up. Livia was not the only one who'd become thinner. His eyes, too, had become more deep-set. The light of a distant street lamp illuminated dramatic hollows underneath his cheeks. The carriage stopped. He opened the door, climbed in, and settled himself on the backward-facing seat.
"Good evening, my lord," said Charlotte, when the hackney was on its way again. "And thank you for coming."
"Tell me what happened. In detail."
He listened to her narrative without any interruptions, one hand set lightly on top of his walking stick, the other beside him on the seat, his face largely invisible in the shadows. A silence rose at the conclusion of her account. She sighed inwardly. She couldn't remember the last time he wasn't displeased with her for one reason or another. In her mind's eye, she saw him down on one knee, chipping away at the dirt encrusted inside an old Roman urn,
While she slowly flipped through the pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica, after he'd kissed her, she'd felt quite free to show up at his ruins, and he'd felt quite free to ignore her. What a beautiful silence that had been. What a lovely era. Looking back on those halcyon days made her feel old. Certainly enough time had passed for many, many things to have gone wrong. All at once she became conscious that he was studying her. Throughout her recital of the events of the day, he had been looking at the top of his walking stick, and occasionally out of the windows. But now his attention was squarely upon her. She, on the other hand, had been half staring at the carriage lantern outside. Carefully she held still, and did not glance toward him. She wanted to go on luxuriating in the weight and intensity of his gaze, to go on wallowing in that bittersweet mingling of pleasure and heartache. How had they managed to not realize for so long what they meant to one another? And why, then, must they see the light when it was too late, when they could possess no more than a few moments of ferocious mutual awareness? He tapped his walking stick against the floor of the hackney, a dull echo that signalled the end of the silence. She inhaled quietly, deeply.
So, the villain in Mrs. Marbleton's case is too mannered for your taste.
His voice was perfectly modulated. She, too, took on a brisk, efficient tone.
I've constructed Bacon's ciphers before. It's tedious work. If I were holding her husband hostage and wanted her to worry, I'd let her stew in her own anxiety, rather than dispatch all these clever but not that clever puzzles.
You imply this Mrs. Marbleton staged an elaborate ruse. Why?
That's what I intend to find out. I'd like for you to forge a letter for me.
You can do that yourself. I've taught you well.
You are still far better than me.
He snorted. I'm better, but not that much better. Whom do you want this letter to be addressed to? And what do you want it to say?
It was not a promise to help, but it was a step closer. I noticed something odd about Mrs. Marbleton. Everything she wore was new, or at least everything that was visible to the observer. I dearly love clothes, but I don't remember ever going about not only in a new frock, but new gloves, new boots, a new hat, and carrying both a new reticule and a new parasol.
Maybe she suffered a fire at her place of domicile.
In my former life I happened to be a devoted browser at Harrods, and saw many of the items she wore on offer there. This evening I made a pilgrimage to that temple of commerce, and asked after the newcomer to London who had bought those items, on the pretense that she had given me a card with her address, and invited me to call, but I'd lost the card, and was quite distraught.
If God doesn't want people to lie, he shouldn't have given the best liars such earnest and innocent faces, murmured Lord Ingram.
For a quick second, it was almost all incandescent pleasure in her heart. She smiled into the dark.
Precisely. Since God obviously intended for me to prevaricate, to do otherwise would be to thwart his purpose. And so I've learned that Mrs. Marbleton currently resides at Claridge's, as that was where her purchases were delivered. Here's something else I suspect about Mrs. Marbleton. She and I might have a great deal in common. The kind of reversal of fortune she suffered, which caused her to fall from the lap of ease, if not of luxury, straight into a scullery. I can think of very few other instances. Even if she lost her parents and had no older siblings who could look after her, what about aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents? What about family friends? What about more genteel employment as a governess or a lady's companion?
You are saying that she
having been caught in a compromising position, chose to run away?
There can't be too many of us. And I'll wager someone like Lady Avery or Lady Summersby would know the circumstances surrounding every last one. If you write an anonymous letter to... Since Lady Avery is already involved in the Sackville case, let's spread the wealth and send it to Lady Summersby, and tell her that a lady who has had a tremendous fall from grace years ago has returned to London and can be found at Claridge's. I dare say within 2 days we'll have her identity.
No.
His answer was quiet, but implacable.
Charlotte tilted her head.
Why not?
You've not thought the matter through, Charlotte. Setting Lady Summersby loose on this woman and having the former announce her true identity from the rooftops? Should Mrs. Marbleton happen to be in real danger of any kind, you will do her a great disservice.
Oh, said Charlotte, she truly had not thought the matter through.
However, there is a premiere performance at Covent Gardens. I can still make the intermission if I hurry. Since it's a night to see and be seen, one of our ladies of gossip should be there.
Make sure you aren't too obvious. Don't let them realize that you've approached them only to ask this question.
He scoffed. Haven't you deduced that these days they approach me, and not the other way around? They're still trying to find out what happened to you. And anyone who knows you to any extent is subject to regular interrogations.
Charlotte, for the moment, had forgotten about her own scandal altogether. What do you tell them? He leaned back in his seat. Once again she felt the impact of his gaze. What did he think when he looked upon her? What did he want? What pain or pleasure unfurled in the deepest part of his heart?
I tell them that I don't know anything, he said quietly, and that I never expect to hear from you again.
When Charlotte returned to Mrs. Watson's house, she found her business partner in the parlour, wrapped in a man's smoking jacket and nursing a glass of claret.
Chateau Aubryon, the 65 vintage.
She held up the darkly scarlet liquid to the light.
My husband adored this wine.
When we married, we bought 4 cases, with the intention of opening a bottle each year for our anniversary. Mrs. Watson turned around.
Would you like to have a glass, Miss Holmes?
Yes, thank you, said Charlotte, sitting down. The wine that John Watson would never taste again was velvety, yet potent. Mrs. Watson refilled her own glass and took a long draught.
I don't usually have reason to consider myself terribly naive, but goodness how naive I've been to think that this would be all fun and games. I keep wondering what must be going through Mrs. Marbleton's mind, Mrs. Watson said, her gaze focused on some distant point. After the telegram came, informing me that my husband had been killed by a stray Jezail bullet, I refused to believe it. I thought they had mistaken a different man for him, that he might be injured and lying somewhere delirious, even that he'd been captured by the Afghanis and held in a dreadful prison. But I couldn't contemplate his death. Couldn't accept it until men from his regiment, men who saw him die before their own eyes and laid him to rest in Kabul, came to offer their condolences. But at least then I knew where he was and what happened to him. Mrs. Marbleton, is it even worse for her because she doesn't know? Is she imagining the most horrific scenarios before telling herself that all would be well? That she would see her husband in one piece again, and this would all turn out to be but a stupid prank. How she must be seesawing between hope and despair, ever diminishing hope, and ever proliferating despair.
Charlotte took another sip of her wine,
If she gave voice to her suspicions concerning Mrs. Marbleton, then Mrs. Watson might stop worrying about Mrs. Marbleton, but she would instead worry about Charlotte.
"But it's perfectly fine for me to worry about you," said an imaginary Lord Ingram.
"Yes," she replied. "Not only fine, but good and proper. Would you like to go to Kabul some day, Mrs. Watson, and visit your husband's grave?"
Mrs. Watson sat down. "I've often thought about it. Sometimes I wish I hadn't left India so precipitously, that I'd made the trip while I'd remained on the subcontinent. But it's such a long way to go to look at a headstone, and to be reminded of all the years that had been robbed."
"If ever again you think of going, ma'am, know that I'd be honoured to accompany you."
Mrs. Watson smiled very slightly. And what would London do without Sherlock Holmes?
"London has managed for millennia without me. I'm sure it can hobble on in my absence for a few months."
Charlotte set down her wine glass.
"Good night, ma'am."
As she reached the door, Mrs. Watson said, "Thank you, Miss Holmes." Charlotte paused briefly, then resumed walking. Lord Ingram's letter came the next morning on the early post. "Dear Charlotte, as expected, Lady Summersby and Lady Avery approached me at the opera. After demurring all knowledge of your whereabouts, I asked them, naturally enough, whether they knew of any precedents like yours, of a young woman who not only defied the rules but also the consequences. With very little hesitation, they brought up the name of Sophia Lonsdale, though they believed that she did not so much run away as was outright disowned. It has been nearly 25 years, but they agree that she found a position working in the refectory kitchens at Balliol College, not too far from her ancestral home. They were certain that she later married a young tutor, shortly before he left the country for a post overseas. Here they became embroiled in dispute over where the young couple had been headed. Lady Avery insisted it was Vienna. Lady Summersby would not budge from Budapest. And there was not enough time to resolve the debate before the curtains rose again. But what they told me of Sophia Lonsdale matched closely with your description of Mrs. Marbleton. Your servant, Ashburton." Charlotte grabbed Mrs. Watson's copy of Burke's. The Lonsdales were a prominent family in Oxfordshire, the most distinguished branch being the one that produced the Earls of Monserre. Sophia Lonsdale probably came from a cadet branch of the family, but still, terribly respectable stock. Alas, there was no time that morning to look further into the matter of Sophia Lonsdale. Charlotte had clients with whom she must meet. By the time she had solved, for a pair of ancient spinster sisters, why their equally ancient butler didn't seem quite himself. The man had died years ago, but one of the sisters kept forgetting the fact, and becoming startled by the sight of a stranger in the house, that the new butler gave up, found a white-haired wig, and with the complicity of the other sister, began passing himself off as his predecessor, another letter arrived from Lord Ingram, much to her surprise. He, unlike Sophia Lonsdale's purportedly missing husband, did not write more than once a day, certainly not without compelling reason.
"Dear Charlotte, a message arrived from Lady Avery just now. She had checked her diary from years ago and admitted that she and her sister were both incorrect as to where the tutor Sophia Lonsdale married went for his next position. It was neither Budapest nor Vienna, but Berlin. The far more important part, however, was buried near the end of her note. Because of the third act starting, she did not have the time to tell me that Sophia Lonsdale died more than 20 years ago, while on holiday in Switzerland. Your servant, Ashburton."
18. Bony like a goat was an unkind description for Becky Birtle, but she was waif-like in appearance, small and thin, with big brown eyes and surprisingly pink lips. Not beautiful, as Mrs. Meek had said, but pretty enough with the smooth skin and good health of youth, and oddly familiar in her features. She sat with her shoulders hunched, her teeth clenched over her lower lip.
"Is it true, Inspector, that Mr. Sackville, someone poisoned him with arsenic?"
"Yes, it's true." A hollowness came into her eyes.
"I thought, when it came out that he'd been murdered, I thought it had to be his brother. But arsenic, that's someone in the house, isn't it?"
"Most likely."
"But why?"
That question was uttered so softly it was addressed more to herself than anyone else.
"He was such a nice person."
"How was he nice?" She looked toward a row of postcards on the mantel, which was but a length of darkened wood beam that must have been salvaged from some other structure. The Birtles' ancient cottage was a far cry from the modern splendour of Curry House. The ceiling was so low, Treddles could scarcely stand straight. The smoke-darkened walls and the scarcity of windows gave the entire interior an air of permanent gloom.
"Mr. Sackville talked to me."
Again, she seemed to be speaking to herself.
"He was the only one who did. Everybody else only told me to do this and that."
"I thought young maids had no leave to speak to the master. How did you and Mr. Sackville become so friendly?"
"We met on the coast path. I took a walk one Sunday afternoon, and so did he. When I saw him, I said I was sorry to be in his way. He said a young lady never needed to apologize for going about her business. Then I told him that I worked for him, and that Mrs. Cornish would have my hide if she knew I spoke to him. He laughed and said, 'Never mind, Mrs. Cornish.' Then he asked me if I wouldn't walk with him for a bit and tell him about myself."
That easy demeanor and friendly curiosity must have made a powerful impact on the girl. "What did you tell him?"
"Hardly anything. He asked about where I was from, how I liked Curry House, if the others treated me proper, and I said Yorkshire, yes sir, and yes sir. He said then if I was too nervous to talk, I didn't need to say aught else."
"How much distance do you think you covered?"
"A mile. Maybe a mile and a furlong."
"Around 25 minutes, then, depending on the terrain and their walking speed." "So you said nothing else the rest of that time?"
"No. But 2 days later, I was in the study dusting. He came in for some papers and saw me with a book in my hand. I thought he'd be angry at me for touching his things, but he only asked what book it was. I told him it was a book about Japan. He asked if I liked it."
She emitted a wistful sigh,
and we started talking.
"Was it always questions on his side and answers on your side?"
"He let me ask him questions, too. If he read all the books in the house, if he'd ever touched an electric switch, if he remembered a time before the Queen was the Queen."
"He answered everything you asked?"
"Not everything. Not when I asked him why he went to London."
Treddles's ears perked. "How and when did that come about?"
"It was my 4th week at the house. Mrs. Cornish made me clean the upstairs sitting room again. Said it weren't done proper the first time. That was when Mr. Sackville came in. He asked me why I looked put out. I explained, and he said it looked perfectly proper to him. I said it was a right travesty."
The girl pronounced the word carefully and with relish.
"That what was good enough for him weren't good enough for Mrs. Cornish. He laughed and said that of course a housekeeper was a greater expert on the cleanliness of the house than the master, and I ought to listen to her. But he was going to London that day. Was there anything that he could get for me from London to make me feel better about having to clean the sitting room twice? I said I didn't have enough money to buy anything. He said it would be a gift. So I told him that I didn't get a good look at London when I passed through, and I'd like a nice postcard. Then it'd be like I got to see at least one good place. He came back with half a dozen for me. Real pretty ones.
Treddles glanced at the mantel. Those ones?
Yes, Inspector.
Treddles moved to the fireplace and examined the postcards. They each bore puncture marks at the corners. You had these on the wall of your room at Curry House?
Yes, Inspector.
Did Mr. Sackville acquire anything from London for anyone else?
I don't reckon so. He said not to say anything to anyone or they'd all want him to fetch things.
Why do you suppose he did that for you? The girl blushed.
He said it was because he was a person to me. That to the others he was only the master of the house, the one they must serve for their wages.
Did he bring you back other items?
Becky Birtle's lips protruded. No, he didn't. Next time he was to go, he asked me if I wanted anything. But he didn't go in the end, had an awful stomachache the day of. The next time he did go, but he had to get off the train at Exeter and spend the night, because he had such a horrible gastric attack.
She gasped.
You don't suppose those gastric attacks... Don't they say arsenic poisoning don't look that different from bad tummy troubles?
Did these attacks happen before Mrs. Meeks became the cook? Treddles already knew the answer. It was the reason he hadn't arrested Mrs. Meek.
For sure they did.
Becky Birtle gasped again.
Stacks of Bibles. I was sick as a dog that night. You don't suppose, Inspector, that I got poisoned too?
Treddles sat up straighter. Did Mr. Sackville eat the same food as the staff?
No. His food was cooked and served separate from ours. But wait,
she thought for a moment.
That was when we were still getting food from the inn. And that week there was a wedding and Mrs. Pegg was cooking for it too. I think everyone at Curry House did eat the same food that week. Soup and fish pies and boiled beef.
Mrs. Pegg was born and brought up in Stanwell Moot. By all accounts, she'd had no dealings with Mr. Sackville whatsoever. Was anyone else sick that day?
No, only me.
Was there anything that only you and Mr. Sackville ate? She hesitated. What was it?
Before he left that day, he was in a good mood. When I ferried up a scuttle of coal, he saw that my fingers were stiff cold. Mrs. Cornish loaned me to help with the wedding, and I was caught in the rain coming back to Curry House. So he asked if I wanted a bit of whiskey to warm up.
Treddles's brows shot up. Mrs. Cornish has been looking for a whiskey decanter, missing since Mr. Sackville's death. She couldn't find it anywhere in the house. Did you take it? Becky Birtle, who had a very direct gaze for a young girl, and had been looking at Treddles for some time, lowered her face. I'll take that as a yes. Have you drunk from it again?
No, I don't even like whiskey.
Then why did you take it?
Because he was really lovely to me that day and I wanted something to remember it by.
Wasn't he always very nice to you?
Yes, but I didn't see much of him after that.
And why is that? Becky Birtle flushed to the roots of her hair and shook her head. This is a murder investigation, Miss Birtle. Do answer my question.
But this is private.
A great many murders have been committed because of what people do in private.
But I didn't do anything. This is just private.
Her reluctance seemed deep-seated. Treddles went on to the next item on his list. The morning you went to give Mr. Sackville his morning cocoa and found him unconscious, why didn't you open the curtains?
What does that have to do with anything?
So it's true you didn't open the curtains.
I mayn't have.
I have been given to understand that it would be highly inappropriate for you to approach him while he lay in bed. And yet you stated this is what you did.
I didn't do anything bad. My first few weeks at Curry House, I ran into him at every corner. I thought we were friends. And then I don't see him for a good long time, and I thought I'd take his hand and jiggle it. A good morning surprise, it's me. Like you would with a mate, if you went to visit them and they were still asleep.
So there was nothing illicit going on between you and Mr. Sackville?
No, that'd be... He must be even older than my dad, and my dad is old.
Her incredulity seemed genuine. Is there anyone in the house who might believe that your rapport with Mr. Sackville isn't quite so innocent? The girl recoiled.
What? Why would they think like that?
Because it isn't normal for the master of the house to develop a friendship with a young maid.
But why are you asking? You think it has something to do with Mr. Sackville's murder?
A number of things could have happened if one of the other members of the household believed that something illicit went on between you and Mr. Sackville. That person might be enraged on your behalf, convinced that you'd been taken advantage of. That person might be enraged on her own behalf. What if she thought she had a romantic understanding with Mr. Sackville? It could be for monetary reasons, too. The person might believe he is to be the chief beneficiary of Mr. Sackville's will and didn't want him getting close to anyone else. Do you see what I mean?
I guess so.
Then can you tell me who might have had suspicions?
She twisted her fingers. Will that person become a suspect?
With no obvious motives, and in a household this small, everybody already is a suspect. It wouldn't be broadening our field of suspects, Miss Birtle, but narrowing it.
I suppose that's all right, then, she said uncertainly. And it really wouldn't make him a suspect, I don't think.
A him? Was it Tommy Dunn?
Tommy? She laughed. Tommy wouldn't care if I fell off the cliffs.
I understand he was initially receptive to having another young person at Curry House. What changed?
Ask him.
Amusement flashed in Becky's eyes, and a trace of smugness. I have. He refused to answer. Perhaps you could help him out. Tell me why and eliminate him from suspicion. This was not strictly true. Even if Tommy Dunn's dislike of Becky had nothing to do with what went on between the latter and Mr. Sackville, he could still be an accomplice, albeit an unlikely one, for Lord or Lady Sheridan.
Only if you swear never to tell anyone.
I can only promise that if it has nothing to do with the case.
It has nothing to do with anything. I caught Tommy with Mr. Weeks, the sexton from Barton Cross, when I was out on a walk.
Her expression turned more somber.
You truly mustn't ever tell anyone, Inspector. I teased Tommy and told him I had a hard time keeping secrets. I didn't mean it, but he was so scared. I was put out that he thought I would tell on him. But he must have been mad with fear. He didn't have anywhere else to go, and Mr. Weeks has children to support. He didn't believe that I'd keep him safe.
Treddles couldn't understand such goings-on between men, but he well knew the consequences of exposure. His secret is safe with me.
Thank you, Inspector,
Becky Birtle said softly. Treddles let a minute of silence pass. They sat almost companionably, he drinking his tepid tea, she nibbling on a biscuit that looked rock hard. So it was Mr. Hodges who noticed something about you and Mr. Sackville? The girl nodded.
The next day after my horrible stomach ache, Mr. Hodges asked if I'd pinched Mr. Sackville's whiskey. I asked him if he was calling me a thief. He said Mr. Sackville is careful about his tummy and don't take more than a few sips, but twice that much was gone from the decanter, and that I was the only other person to go in that room. So I told him that I did drink, but only because Mr. Sackville offered, and it would have been rude to refuse. Mr. Hodges scowled something mighty and said gentlemen was different than regular folk. Nobody holds them accountable, and I'd better have a care for myself. She turned her face to the side. With a start, Treadles understood why she had looked oddly familiar when he met her for the first time. The picture of a young Mrs. Cornish that he had seen at Curry House. There was a good resemblance, if one happened to see Becky from certain angles. He had considered Mrs. Cornish from the perspective of a scorned lover, an angry bystander, and opportunistic collaborator. But Mrs. Cornish, as a deeply concerned kinswoman, opened an entire new vista of possibilities. When you left, Mrs. Cornish said you took a photograph of the staff as a memento.
I didn't leave. Mrs. Cornish dismissed me, said I was making too much of a nuisance of myself, fainting and crying.
She flattened her lips.
Maybe I was. And I never took that photograph. The only person I'd have wanted to remember was Mr. Sackville, and he wasn't in it. I found the picture in my suitcase after I came home.
The discrepancies made Treadles's heart pound. Having Becky hundreds of miles away, and the only image of her exiled from the house, would ensure that no one suspected any blood ties between the two.
I'd like to see the photograph. And I'll need you to hand me the decanter of whiskey.
Becky Birtle excused herself and returned with both items. Treadles examined the decanter, which still contained 2 inches of intoxicant. It occurred to him that Becky Birtle could have emptied and replaced the contents of the decanter, but a quick sniff was enough to let him know that the amber fluid inside was no cheap grog, but the best Scotland had to offer. He next turned his attention to the photograph. The captured images of Mrs. Cornish and Becky Birtle did not show much likeness, but all the same, Treadles asked Becky Birtle to fetch her parents. Mr. Birtle, a former gamekeeper who could no longer work on account of his arthritis, was indeed old for someone with so young an only child. His wife was a square slab of a woman, and possibly even older than he. Becky Birtle closed the door and left, her footsteps fading away on the squeaky floorboards. Treadles waited until she was out of hearing range.
Mr. Birtle, Mrs. Birtle, I understand that the questions I am about to ask will seem intrusive. I hope you will forgive me.
The couple looked at each other.
Yes, Inspector.
Mrs. Birtle sounded as if she rarely spoke, her voice resembling the rasp of rusted gears forced to rotate.
I must ask whether you are Becky's natural parents.
Another look exchanged between the Birtles. Mrs. Birtle wiped her hand on her apron.
Why do you need to know, Inspector?
I'm investigating a murder. None of the suspects with the means to have committed it appear to have concrete motives. Therefore, I must get to the bottom of every possible connection among all parties involved. If you are concerned the information might get someone into trouble, please consider that withholding the necessary intelligence from me may result in an innocent bystander being charged with the crime.
Mr. Birtle placed his hand atop his wife's. Mrs. Birtle glanced at her husband, and then looked Treadles in the eye.
We took Becky in the day she was born, and raised her as if she were our own.
Treadles let out the breath he didn't realize he was holding.
And is Mrs. Cornish of Curry House Becky's natural mother?
Mrs. Birtle nodded.
Thank you for your trust in me.
Treadles inclined his head.
I will do my best to keep this from becoming public knowledge.
It felt almost unsettling to finally have a prime suspect. But the scenario made sense. Mr. Hodges must have told Mrs. Cornish about the closer-than-necessary rapport between their employer and Becky Birtle.